I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, July 1st, episode 92 of Pandemic. In this episode, listener, we're going to look at Yemen, where the concerns are fundamental. How can a response to a pandemic be mounted during a conflict that has killed over 230,000 people since 2014, accompanied by rolling humanitarian emergencies? That's what I've been discussing with Ahmed Mahat, head of mission with the aid organisation MSF in Yemen. That's next. Ahmed Mahat, head of mission with Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders in Yemen. Thanks very much for talking to us on the Pandemic podcast. I suppose I just want to ask you, first of all, going back to 2020, can you lay out for us what it was like when the first wave of COVID-19 hit the country?
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you. In 2020, we had the outbreak of COVID in Yemen. And it was huge because in both the south and the north of the country was really affected. Majority of the health structures are functioning at 50% due to conflict, but also it's also related to past epidemics, but also some of the healthcare workers are not being facilitated in regards to payment. And as you know, with conflict, majority of Yemeni health professionals left the country. So it was some of the around 10 or 20% of the facilities are functional to fully functional, but 50% are really partly functional, like 50% of its capacity due to conflict, but also it's also related to HR problem.
The poverty, the malnutrition, the level of underlying disease that was already there in Yemen before COVID-19 struck, as well as the problems caused by the conflict. Perhaps you could lay out how vulnerable that made Yemen before COVID came to the country.
Well, going back to, you know, the root cause of this, you know, the country is going into the seventh year of conflict. And with this, Yemen was not really spared from, you know, the exhibition that was brought in by the conflict. But at the same time, we also had, you know, outbreaks of cholera. We had malnutrition cases also at some of the facilities and some governorates. And at the same time also, we you know, the health system wasn't really functional, you know, due to lack of adequate HR. So with all this, at the moment with COVID, it's also really difficult because most of the people are still, you know, coming back to the community engagement and risk communication wasn't really well done within the population. So the health-seeking behavior wasn't also that really good. So there are so many factors, you know, that led to the population not having access to these facilities.
And when you say there was a HR problem in the health service, how did that manifest itself? Did doctors... were there just simply not enough doctors, or had medical staff left the country? What was the problem?
Yeah, so during the conflict, majority of the health professionals left the country. For those who are remaining at the moment in the country, in some of parts of the country, they are not being facilitated. They are not receiving their salary since 2015. So some of them, they just left the public hospitals. Some are working with the private facilities. And for those who are working at the facility level, so they are not really available at the facility. So these are some of the issues that we are seeing on the ground. We have been advocating as MSF with other actors to make sure that there is a sustainable solution to ensure that all those healthcare workers should, you know, have their salaries, because they should not be subjected to political affiliation.
And what are the hospital supplies like? Oxygen supplies in the current circumstances, medical supplies, drugs like, we'll say, ivermectin, remdesivir, that have been used to treat the inflammation caused by COVID, and indeed the vaccine supplies. But in order, I suppose, to, first of all, to treat people who are already sick, oxygen and some of the drugs to mitigate the sickness. What are the supplies like in Yemen at the moment?
Well, during the first wave, really, as I told you, there was no preparedness level at the first, at the country level, from the government, but also from the organizations that have been supporting the government. So what we have observed is that there was no medical supplies in the country. Oxygen is an issue during the first wave. And is, and also it is also an issue at the moment, also during the second wave. So we had the quality of oxygen we receive is also really not that good, and the contractors that are providing oxygen, doing the provision of the oxygen cylinders, are overwhelmed with the number of cases we are seeing at the moment, and they cannot cope up with the quantity we need at the country level. So oxygen is really a big deal. At the same time, also the medical supplies are not really sufficient. So there are no drugs to treat COVID-19. And then, so the healthcare workers in some of the areas have not been really clearly trained to respond to COVID-19 patients' needs. These are some of the challenges we have seen at the field level. So for MSF, we are trying at the moment as much as possible to prepare for the third wave as well, to ensure that we have a sustainable solution in regards to provision of oxygen. So we are trying to put in place some oxygen generating plant in areas that we are supporting at the moment, to ensure that at least we have sustainability in regards to provision of oxygen. We do have medical supplies for managing cases at our facility level, but we really want to make sure that through advocacy with other NGOs to ensure that those facilities at hard-to-reach areas have access to oxygen provision, have access to medical supplies, and also the communities around should be really engaged in regards to COVID-19.
And as far as ventilators go, because you mentioned there is a human resource problem, doctors, nurses and the like having moved abroad, what is the situation with ventilators for very sick patients? Because highly specialised skills are needed in order to cope with people, to put them on ventilators and then to look after them in an intensive care setting. What would the picture be like in Yemen for that?
You are right. So the thing is that it's really difficult because, you know, those specialties like anesthesiologists are not really available. Because for us, we bring in some expert to support the local, the national staff in managing COVID. In some of the areas, we don't have really well-trained staff to manage these, because with the ventilators, you also need to have some of the drugs control drugs. What we have observed is that in first wave, there was a distribution of ventilators to some of the facilities. Training were not done. There is no medical supply that's coming with this. So during our observation at the field level, we try to share some of our observation with the organization that are, you know, doing a kind of providing ventilator to some of the facilities without doing proper training for the staff, without ensuring that there is medical supplies to manage the cases. So in some facilities, you will see there is a presence of ventilators, but the staff are not trained. And also, there are no specialties that can deal with this, that can use the machine itself.
You mentioned that the other effort that you're trying to strengthen is the public health effort. I mean, supplies of personal protection equipment, both for medical staff and for ordinary people, going about their business and also testing in order to conduct test and trace. What's the supply of PPE like, and how well developed or how widespread is a testing system in Yemen?
So in regards to provision of PPE, I think at the moment there are some PPEs available in the country. Currently, there are only around six PCR testing capacity. We have six PCRs across the country, in Aden and also in some of the governors under the government control. In the north, there are around four functioning PCR machines. But the turnaround time for the results is really not really that really good, because sometimes you really need to have the results within 24 hours. But we end up receiving results within 48 to 72 hours. So it's really late. And in regards to rapid response team that have been doing, you know, sample collection, in the north, they have not been facilitated by the organization they're supposed to do. In the south, it is working, south of the country, where the government is you know, we're under the government control. But in the north, it's not really working, and they have not been really facilitated. So this is the main challenge. So we really have some challenges in regards to having results on time.
And in order to, I suppose, quarantine people who are traveling between areas or while they're awaiting their test results, is that possible? Do you have the facilities to quarantine people, or is that simply impossible with the situation you're dealing with at the moment?
No, it's not really possible, because the thing is that we do testing for the patients that are admitted at the treatment unit. So for these patients, we normally take samples to, you know, to have the result. But for those patient, people at home, I don't think we can follow, because there is also a lack of contact tracing at the community level. We don't know what's happening at the community level. The pillar of risk community engagement and risk communication is really very weak across the country. Still, there's a lot of misconception within the community. So we don't really understand what is happening within the community. Because there are some patients that are not coming to the facility. They are being treated at home. And we have seen also the behavior of the patient, because within the community, we have also seen that patients are really arriving very, very late to the facilities, you know, when the prognosis is really bad. So we don't really understand, because the community engagement and risk communication is not really working really well.
And how far would people have to travel typically to get to a health facility? I mean, are the health facilities based understandably in large cities? And if so, what kind of distances are you seeing people travel in order to access help, even later on in their sickness when they're getting into distress?
At the moment, we have big treatment centers, COVID treatment centers, at the city level. For example, in Sana'a, we have two treatment centers. In Aden, we had two treatment centers. And then across the governorate, we have some, isolation units where we treat the patient. So at the city level, like in the big, you know, like cities like Aden and Sana'a, we are seeing patients coming as far as 5 hours drive. Some of them are coming, you know, from Aden. We are seeing patients coming from Abyan, coming from Adale, which is like 3 to 4 hours drive. So it depends on the services that are available at their facility level, because some of them, they don't have ICU capacity. So our ICU in both Sana'a and Aden is really full, you know, to capacity. And at the governorate level, there is no capacity to treat severe cases. So majority of the time, we receive really very severe cases at our facility level. At one point we have so many severe cases, and we cannot really cope up with them with the 15 bed ICU, for example. So we have to treat them at the IPD level. So we don't have the capacity. So these are some of the lessons learned during the second wave. So hopefully for the third wave, we will make sure that we can have maybe high dependency unit, you know, within the IPID ward to absorb some of the severe cases. And also we will advocate more with other actors on the ground to ensure that there is intensive care unit capacity for severe cases.
Okay. And IPD stands for?
Inpatient department.
Inpatient department. I beg your pardon. That's, I'm showing my medical ignorance there. Could you tell me what the role of the conflict is? Because, you know, you've been dealing, as you said, with 7 years of conflict. There has been ceasefires. There have been ceasefires which have then broken down. But the impact of people on the move in makeshift accommodation with maybe inadequate sanitation, how has that impacted on the spread of COVID within Yemen?
The issue is that, you know, you have the de facto authority in the north and also in the south. Also, you have the government, and also there's a bit of division within the government, between the government and some of the political and some of the parties to conflict in the south. So it's really difficult. It's really difficult, mostly for the internally displaced population in Marib and across the country. The issue is that there was no, you know, a public health approach from the government and also from the authorities in the north, because life continued. Nothing has been shut down. Schools are still open. The marketplace are still functioning. There was no approach from the authorities in both sides, you know, of the conflict, ensuring that at least the cessation of movement, you know, in other countries, at least you have lockdowns and for a few weeks or some months to control the epidemic. But here, no, nothing has been put in place. So still, at the moment, we are observing that the cases are on the decreasing trend, you know, across the country. We are seeing a decrease in the number of cases at the moment across the country. And but really, there was no major public health measures that have been put in place to contain the COVID-19 pandemic.
And you say the de facto authorities in the north, and by that I take it you mean Ansar Allah, also known as the Houthi movement. There has been a recent report by Human Rights Watch to say that they, after initially being in favour of the vaccination, have not shown themselves to be in favour of the vaccination recently. I mean, what has the vaccination rollout been like? It sounds like you have a very limited supply in doses in the tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands, should I say, rather than in the millions which you would need.
Correct. Yes. So the thing is that we received, you know, the country received 360,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine as a first batch. And in a country where you have 30 million, a population of 30 million, that is nothing, you know, compared, you know, if you really want to make sure that everyone have access to the vaccination. So with the COVAX committee, they donated around 2.3 million doses of AstraZeneca vaccine. And out of that, the country received 360 doses. So in areas under the control of Ansar Allah, at the beginning, they had requested to have 100,000 doses, but later on, they kind of say no to this. But currently, they ordered for 10,000 doses. So there is vaccination ongoing at the moment in the north, mostly targeting healthcare workers that are working at the COVID isolation units or treatment centers. In the south, there was a vaccination activity that was conducted, but still the coverage is very low. You know, the uptake was really low. There was no sensitization of the community or the healthcare workers. Mostly the first target is healthcare workers. So there is vaccine hesitancy among the healthcare workers. There was no sufficient communication that was done, at least for people to accept the vaccination. So yeah, it's really difficult, and we are now waiting for the second batch, for the second dose. Hopefully we'll see how it goes, but really the coverage is very, very low, and there was no communication done, no sufficient communication done in regards to dissemination of information on the importance of having a vaccine.
And finally then, could I ask you, in terms of what the needs are, the Mark Lowcock, the humanitarian rapporteur for the UN, was saying that you have tens of thousands of people who are already suffering from severe malnutrition and starvation, with around 5 million people in near famine conditions behind them. I mean, where is the greatest need at the moment? Obviously, COVID is one problem, but there are other problems as well. There seems to be shortages of humanitarian supplies and even basics like fuel, which would be needed to pump water if you did want to roll out a response to sanitation or to fuel hospitals, as you say, that are running at 50% capacity. So where's the greatest need as you see it at the moment in Yemen?
There are really a plethora of needs in the country, because at the moment the conflict is still ongoing. There are so many wounded at some of the front lines. The front lines are still active. We are still at areas of intervention. Our areas of intervention, we see malnourished children, but also adults. You know very well that food intake in Yemen is really insufficient, and in addition to that, there is high prevalence of diseases such as, you know, seasonal malaria and diarrhea peak, you know, in the country. So these are also a major driver of malnutrition. So for us, at the areas of our intervention, we are seeing malnutrition cases, but we don't say that there is impending famine at the moment. But we do see and treat malnutrition cases. So for now, I think there are a lot of things needs to be done. First of all, there is a need to powerful countries like the US really needs to push that there is a peaceful resolution. There should be ceasefire within the country, and there is also need to ensure that the humanitarian funding was not really the defunding of majority of the UN organization, because underfunding of the UN organization, because this year they requested for $3.5 billion, but they only received half of that. And you know, we also see the consequences of this, because some of the primary health facilities that have been treating malnutrition cases are not doing that anymore. We are seeing cases that can be treated at the primary healthcare facilities coming to our secondary healthcare facilities. So we have been really also having bilateral discussions with the donors, at least to ensure that there is continuity of funding to some of the organization working in Yemen. We also advocated for hands-on operation for majority of the organization, because it is only MSF that is on the ground doing hands-on intervention, because the majority of the other actors, you know, they just do a remote operation. So we felt alone sometimes at the field level. But really, there are a lot of things that really needs to be done. So COVID is one of them. You have the malnutrition activity, your malnutrition cases within the country. You also have displaced population needs to have access to healthcare. We have seen areas hard to reach areas also needs to be really having access to healthcare as well. The immigrant issue also really needs to be followed, because immigrants' health also really needs to be followed in the country, because there are majority of immigrants passing through Yemen going to Saudi. So, and
do you mean people traveling from the Horn of Africa, from Ethiopia and Djibouti, transiting through Yemen?
Yeah. So their health also really needs to be addressed. So there are so many things that really needs to be done. And all this can be achieved if there is a concerted effort from the donors. Make sure that the NGOs working are funded, make sure that there is hands-on operation in some of the areas to ensure that also COVID is really well taken care of, because the preparedness level is really not that great at the moment.
Ahmed Mahat, the MSF head of mission in Yemen, thanks very much for talking to us on the Pandemic Podcast.
Thank you very much, Colm, and it's nice talking to you.
Thanks very much for spending the time with us.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
And that's it for another episode. If you have feedback, drop me a line on colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain. Or get me on Twitter at colmomongain. Subscribe or give us a review on your podcast platform of choice, where you can also find past episodes. But until next week, from me, Colm O'Mungain, take care, stay safe, and thanks for listening.